5 years ago, I was paying $65 a month for my subscriptions. Today, those same subscriptions cost $111, and I don't even use half of them anymore. That's why now I use Rocket Money to manage my subscriptions for me. The app gives you a list of all your subscriptions and reminds you of upcoming payments so you're not hit with any surprise charges. On top of that, it also sends you alerts when subscription prices go up, so you always know the price you're paying. If you decide you no longer want a subscription, you can cancel it right from the app. No customer service needed. And the best part is, Rocket Money even reaches out and tries to get you refunded for some of the money you lost. On average, people that cancel their subscriptions with Rocket Money save $378 a year. And overall, Rocket Money has saved its members $880 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
The following is intended for bizarre audiences only. Welcome to the Midnight Library.
Madam, I have this quarter's predictions from the Divine Disembodied Ones.
Oh, yes. What silliness have the Severed Six got for me? And this better not be about ducks again. I don't care what ducks do.
They seem to be on strike, madam. They're unhappy with their working conditions.
On strike? This is number three's idea, isn't it? He's been head of their union for far too long.
I fear that's precisely their point, madam. They have names, and yet you call them by numbers. They want more vacation days and pillows to lie upon, or at least new spikes to be jammed onto.
Oh, really? Well, then, these old heads shall roll. I'm sure my spooky lovely guests adore me so much that we'll soon have six new volunteers eager for the chop to become my own set of helpful talking heads.
I very much doubt it.
What was that?
No doubt about it.
Secure that door, Mr. Darling. I can still hear the voices of the below-stairs staff. Yes. Very good. Thank you. Yes, good evening. Nice to see you, Miss Ruthie. You've brought a treat for the wolf pups. How kind. If I were you, I would toss it to them instead of trying to hand-feed them. You may have heard they're fond of ladyfingers. No need to cook it next time. They're used to a raw diet. Everyone find a cozy spot? Oh, no. Don't worry about that. You can go over there by it. That guillotine is our Mr. Cutlass. It's just a prop for reference. It works, though, so don't futz with it. Welcome to the Midnight Library, my dear guests. I am your headstrong headmistress, Miranda Merrick. Tonight's topic to delight in the reading room is one that many of you undoubtedly have a fascination with, because you have something all of those involved in the topic once had. A human head. Personally, I love the macabre idea of a head having to think about the unfathomability of being beheaded. What a wild kind of innermost terror to imagine. We have so much to get to. A brief history of beheadings, the methods of beheadings, famous beheadings. So exciting. But first, I want to tell you a bit of old scuttlebutt about a totally different old library from long, long ago and far away from here, with a family of powerful women. Who were so beloved by their friends that these friends volunteered to sacrifice themselves in order to serve these women. Now, of course, this is all totally made up gossip or old wives' tales for certain, but the cute old story that I'm certain I read here in a book claimed that six devotees of the women, who were all beautiful, mighty, and mystical, by the way, six human people willfully and cheerfully had their own heads lopped off so they could become immortal visionaries in eternal servitude of these wonderful women. And their gifted offspring. Down through the ages, these soothsaying heads spoke aloud and predicted and warned the women of coming events and spiritual happenings and village uprisings. Eventually, though, even though it was true that this was a guaranteed way to become immortal, eventually, the talking heads sometimes became, disoriented or off or resentful or foppish or something. I mean, who can say what goes on in an old severed head? And those heads would be retired and lovingly, kept in a hat box in the attic or something, of the wonderful women. But I do know there were always six, and I know that they were supposed to tell spooky and bewitching bedtime stories to the women's adorable little granddaughter. But they told her a bunch of goofy junk instead about some doof named Mary who rode a lamb to school or something, and then some drivel about a bunch of half-witted bears that ate porridge instead of people. And then the six bodiless boneheads couldn't understand why the grown-up little girl never took them seriously. On the hospitality tray, we have some finely aged head cheese made from, the head of something, by our Natasha. There's a little dish of eyes you can skewer with cocktail forks, and a long tray of sliced tongue. If you find that off-putting, well, you can just wrap it all up in the head bread that's there, I guess. Well, let us begin our head hunt, shall we? For once, I'll begin with a mildly abridged and enhanced version of the definition of beheading from the writings of Mr. Britannica, a signed copy. Of course. Beheading is a mode of executing capital punishment by the manner of severing the head from the body. Hopefully in one fell swoop. It's as simple as that. Now, please know that I tried like the devil to find some reliable information regarding the first known beheadings, but all that I discovered were glossy old writings waxing philosophically about the first blades that were created. And one might gather from that the first beheadings quickly followed. Humans are pragmatic and industrious like this, especially when it comes to doing away with other humans. Now, so as not to be perceived as too flippant or garish, I should like to state up front that removal of a human head is grisly business, but I shall endeavor to accompany you to the end of this tale without too much drama, absolutely zero political or nationalist commentary, and with the inclusion of some historically compelling tellings of some famous, for various reasons, beheadings. From history, there are writings that this method of punishment was employed by the ancient Greeks and Romans, and was believed to be, quote, an honorable way to die. So perhaps bear this in mind. But I don't know about you, but this offering of an honorable beheading cuts no ice with me. I've read that initially axes or broad axes were utilized for the task, and one would surmise that the broader the axe, the better. If you were the chop-ee, you'd pray for a one-and-done neat job of it, and not several whacks with only a narrow blade making its way through your neck with each strike. Later, daggers and long swords were put to use for the critical task, and Japan was thought to have some of the finest swords used for beheadings beginning in the 15th century. Contrary to popular belief, the French guillotine was not the next bloody step in the evolution of the, dare I say, art of decapitation. There were earlier versions of this mechanical murdering device, possibly as early as 1066, coinciding with the Battle of Hastings. It only takes a little imagining to arrive at the conclusion that people from these times were beginning to feel, or perhaps had always felt, that it might be nice to have a way to still cut someone's head off, but to somehow be a little less intimately involved with the process. They wanted a more impersonal type of life-ending violence. So, in these early times, we see a change from an executioner physically bringing a blade in hand down to make the deadening cut himself, to an executioner activating a device or machine by pulling a pin or cutting a rope that would cause the blade to fall from a height, completing the deadly duty. Now, I cannot guess if the executioner slept better at night, but this newfangled assassin's apparatus certainly would have kept his uniform clean. One of the first documented machines to accomplish this more palatable punishment was called the Halifax Gibbet, from a time during the 1280s. It was constructed in West Yorkshire, England, and put to use for casually executing criminals, unbelievably for the crime of petty theft. This device featured a heavy axe head affixed into a groove of a sizable wooden block that had protruding wood or metal rods on both ends of it, and these fit into tracks on the inner sides of two tall beams on both sides of the axe-bearing block. A crossbeam high upon the top of the two uprights was fitted with a simple pulley through which a long rope was fed, and tied to a ring on top of the wooden block that couched the head of the heavy axe, allowing it to be raised 15 feet in the air. And, well, I'm sure you understand how well it works. This device was in use for nearly 400 years, until 1650, when Oliver Cromwell had it outlawed and dismantled. The Halifax Gibbet is believed to have taken roughly 100 heads in its time. That's only for a year. Renaissance Italy saw the creation of a similar machine called the Mannaia, which translates into blade or chopper. And in approximately the same era, Scotland brought forth the charmingly named Scottish Maiden, or simply the Maiden, a large, ominous, angular beheading contraption that was constructed of strong oak timbers and a wide, sharp iron blade embedded in a massive lead weight that would be hoisted high above the doomed person's hopefully long neck. The maiden was gifted for use to the city of Edinburgh by the Lord Provost and Magistrates of Edinburgh in 1564, and remained in use until 1710, claiming in its time over 150 heads. The genuine article can be seen up close in the Kingdom of Scots National Museum of Scotland, where it is impressively on display. And it is terrifying. I'd like to tell you, dear guest, that in combing our incandescent shelves and reading through the seemingly endless pages of writings about beheadings, I noticed the same phrase or wording and implied reasoning for beheadings being used over and over, calling the act of decapitation a punishment. Now, punishment always seemed to me to be something that you are subjected to in order to learn from your wrongdoing so that you might see the error of your ways, correct yourself, and behave appropriately in the future. Fines, jailing, solitary confinement, floggings, these are all punishments. Beheading, on the other hand, seems just a bit heavy-handed for the description of punishment to me. This is the end of my editorial. Now we have the arrival of the French-born guillotine on the bloody scene. This is fascinating because the implementation of it was born out of one man's disdain for capital punishment. Dr. Joseph Guillotin was firmly against the barbaric act of hacking a person's head off as the penalty for their crime. He lobbied against this form of punishment in 1789, proclaiming that the severing of a person's head from their body was too gruesome because sometimes several slashes with a sword or axe were often needed to complete the horrific act. Accepting that this type of death sentence wasn't going to be abolished or even curtailed anytime soon, the good doctor, in the interest of a more humane type of decapitation, which is weird to even say, suggested the fabrication and implementation of, in his opinion, a kinder head-removing mechanism. He even helped to oversee the design and building of the prototype, which was undertaken by another doctor, Antoine Louis, and, strangely enough, a musician and harpsichord maker named Tobias Schmidt. So why didn't the finished model play a chord to muffle the sound of the, chop-thump? Honestly, do I have to think of everything? Anyway, after a few practice runs using some volunteer corpses, the grim new device was put to work on April 25th, 1792, and was indeed found to be more accurate and efficient at its job than the manual method formerly utilized. In fact, Parliament, the public, or the courts, or someone liked the invention so much that it became known as the guillotine in honor of its advocate and foreman, who was horrified by this and petitioned the French government to remove his name in association with the deadly device. The fact that you know without question the word guillotine tells you how successful his campaign was. And now a word from tonight's sponsor, the League of Lady Gravediggers. The League of Lady Gravediggers use all manner of gravedigging skills. Bodies whole and divided are their muse, any old how they were killed. Drown in a swamp or stomped by a goon, the ladies will search for that stiff. They'll search as they drift in a hot air balloon to find the ones pitched off a cliff. They gather the hetzed, the ripped, and the shredded, the deceased in a group or alone. They do like tending the newly beheaded. They love when they let out a groan. Burials for all, unless you're the gifted and your head becomes library staff. Your body gets buried, but your head will be lifted to foresee on Ms. Merrick's behalf. Be sure to predict the witch's good luck. Be sure to be a useful chatterbox. And don't yammer on about the love life of ducks, or you'll end up in an attic hatbox. The League of Lady Gravediggers would like to invite you down to Possum Park for a fall softball exhibition game. Gather your friends to make up a team and take a swing at a pitch from Big Lou. Mind you, she's 6'2" and pitches at 92 miles per hour. Her last three attempted batters were lovingly buried here in our woods. If you've got something that needs to be buried, call the girls who dig as fast as they pitch at 976-DITCH-WITCHES. Well, let's continue and make some headway, shall we? I believe that your head will find this next bit of macabre information as interesting as mine did. Due to the efficiency of the French guillotine, literally thousands of people were forced to part with their heads. These were the so-called enemies of the French Revolution, mainly consisting of the defunct nobility, members of the church, and those found to be hoarding money, food, or anything crucial or of value. In the mid-1790s, during the appropriately named Reign of Terror, the decapitation contraption's blade met with more than 20,000 nervous necks. Now, you may know that these were public executions for any person of any age to stand and witness. But what you may not know is that this decidedly bloody movement, in defense of the common people's rights, generated a celebratory, spectacle-type atmosphere that surrounded the guillotine. It became a daily show to which wide-eyed people showed up in droves to behold. Different doomed figures elicited different levels of responses from the crowd, with applause, heckles, and cheers being sent toward the stage that held the soon-to-be-headless condemned person. The more the guilty person was known for having abused their power, the louder the crowd roared when their head was detached. In turn, the ill-fated sometimes behaved bizarrely as they ascended the platform, shouting slurs at the crowd or even dancing their way up the steps, inciting louder jeers from the frenzied spectators on the ground below. And the famous beheading blade, the guillotine, had poems, stories, and jaunty pub songs and even jokes written about it. Near the platform, souvenirs of the machine could be purchased, little artistic paintings on china plates, even miniature guillotine earrings. A pair was handed down to me by my French grandmother, but I don't wear them in public. Printed programs were available to the crowd that listed who was up for the chop that day, so that a person or group didn't miss the beheading of some aristocrat or clergyman who nearly starved their family. Women, who were forbidden to assemble politically at the time, gathered in groups around the machine, engaging in knitting together, which was a way of defiantly assembling, as they waited for the executions to take place. The operators of the machine became local heroes and even national celebrities, with people wanting to congratulate and shake the hand of the man who had lopped off the head of a king or queen. We working models of the guillotine were fashioned into toys for children who practiced on dolls, and fancier versions sat as novelty items on dinner tables to slice bread and vegetables. So, ironically, the guillotine death machine had become a way of life. Speaking of life, if you would like to live to eternity, our additional sponsor of tonight's reading in the Midnight Library is not brought to you by the six severed soothsaying heads that are totally not here in the Midnight Library. It's true that we once fell under the spell of Miss Merrick's lovely grandmothers. But she became an evil bombshell, nothing like her kindly others. So why would you want to take our place and lop off your head for this witch? Well, she does have a certain spooky grace. Let us give you our very best pitch. Once your head is cut loose, the fun begins. You're not dead, but more fully alive. You see demons and ghosts and hear violins, and there's nothing that you can't survive. Number 3 was chucked into the fireplace and bounced out with a mouth full of ash. Number 4 was dropped into a pit of snakes and bit the biggest one right in half. You eat all you like and never gain weight. It just falls out your neck with your drink. Ms. Merrick is weird, but her magic is great, and she's not nearly as bad as you think. Who wrote this? The Divine Decapitated Six invite you to stroll over to meet Mr. Cutlass and have a pet of his strong wooden beams and admire his razor-sharp blade that is best viewed from the bottom up. Just to have a little lie down there and see how it feels. Go ahead. Now hurry to get to the head of the line before all 6 slots are taken. What silliness. Now, given that I spoke of the art of decapitation earlier, I thought now I'd mention just a few rather startling depictions of decapitations in art. Seriously, you may want to jot these down to have a peep at them later because, for reasons that have probably been lost to the ages, some of the most talented artists have chosen to paint some of the most abhorrent scenes of beheadings. Most, unsurprisingly, in the name of religion and mythology. I could probably host a 3-hour-long reading describing a glorious collection of the individual works, but here I will simply list a few titles or themes that I do believe, given that you're here in the first place, dear guests, that you might like to see. Let's travel from tamish to gorish, shall we? Less bloody and more serene because this scene is usually portrayed after the beheading, several artists painted Salome with the head of John the Baptist on a platter. The sheer variety of styles and moods showing the lifeless head are compelling. Next, there's David, shown generally holding aloft the enormous head of the giant Goliath, mostly with more triumph than blood being the point of the art. Then there's our Natasha's least favorite, the more mythical paintings and sculptures depicting the slaying of Medusa, the beautiful snake-haired goddess. I know Medusa is actually a monster, but, we say goddess out of respect for our Natasha. Here again, you'll find you're seeing the subject after their beheading. But lastly, if it's blood ye be wanting, then blood ye shall have. Simply have a look at nearly any painting of Judith beheading Holofernes. The most violent, in my opinion, is by Caravaggio. Caravaggio seems to know precisely how an artery would behave when interrupted by a blade. Those of you among us in search of an alternative medium other than paintings in which to admire horrific beheadings, well, you may want to seek out beheadings featured in stained glass windows, because some of the most heavenly hosted churches and cathedrals are very pleased to show you some of the most unforgiving beheadings you will ever behold. And let's have a few noted happenings from the scandalous scaffold. In 1542, when the fifth wife of Henry VIII, Catherine Howard, learned that she was to be beheaded, she unbelievably requested that the chopping block, upon which one rests their outstretched neck in order to be killed, be brought to her prison cell so that she might practice getting the placement of her head right for her last public appearance. Catherine was believed to be as young as 17 at the time of her execution. The doomed extravagant queen, Marie Antoinette, has always been believed to have uttered an apology upon arriving on the platform to face the guillotine, the same guillotine that took her husband's head 10 months earlier. She was reportedly heard to quietly say, "Pardon me, sir, I did not mean to do it." But it is also believed that this was no confession or statement of regret regarding her charges, but an earnest plea for forgiveness for unintentionally stepping upon the executioner's foot. Sir Walter Raleigh, Queen Elizabeth's on-again, off-again favorite, when finally meeting his executioner upon the axeman's platform, was heard to exclaim that he did not want his enemies to think that he, quote, quaked from fear at the moment of his appointment with death. So he shouted up from his knelt position, ordering his executioner to strike, man, strike! Giving him the appearance of being in command right up to his last moment. Then there's the curious persistent belief that some severed heads remained animated in the moments after their chop. The head of guillotined murderess Charlotte Corday was taken in 1793 and lifted for the crowd to see. François Lagrou was said to have brazenly slapped both of her cheeks, causing the onlookers to gasp as the face boldly winced and grimaced. And the other wife of King Henry VIII, ordered to death via the guillotine's blade, Anne Boleyn, was said to have tried to speak in the seconds after her head was detached. Witnesses claimed that her lips quivered and parted in an attempt to speak. The belief that a bodiless head is aware for up to several minutes is still debated today, with experts' best assumptions estimating that residual oxygen present in the brain may make it possible for the beheaded to be consciously aware for perhaps as long as 10 to 15 seconds. Unless you happen to be one of those lucky, powerful, immortal heads that become gifted prophets for that hauntingly magical woman, who totally is not me, in a faraway enchanted library. That's totally not this one. But if you think you are under the spell or have feelings of delusions that you might want to be one, maybe see us afterwards so we can help you get that resolved. We could have tea and discuss it at least. And if not, Mr. Darling will see you out. Good night, my dear guests. Good night.
Well, how many happy-to-be-headless volunteers do we have, Mr. Darling? Wait, let me guess. 12.
We have precisely the opposite of 12, madam. 0. In fact, the guests exited more quickly than usual. The Divine Six have more demands.
Well, pee water. Fine. What do 5 and 6 want? Oh, wait, sorry. What do the Beardy Weirdy twins want?
Their names are Hannah and Anna, madam, and their beards are a genetic gift they're very proud of.
Whatever. What do they want?
Beard conditioner.
Ugh, it's going to be a long night, isn't it, darling?
Practically endless, madam.
The Midnight Library is proudly brought to you by me, Miranda Merrick, and Astonishing Legends. The excellent sound design is by Chris at Sounds Like an Earful. We are kindly sponsored by our spooky, lovely patrons. If you would like to do as they've done and step beyond the cordoned off areas, visit patreon.com/midnightlibrary. Join our Patreon and you'll hear directly from me. Just make sure your notifications are on. Find us in your local cemetery and on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Our bizarre merch can be found at redbubble.com/people/midnightlibrary.
Coda just made riding the bus easier than ever. Now you can pay your Coda fare by tapping your smartphone, smartwatch, or card, just like you do at the coffee shop or grocery store. Love paying with smart card? Keep doing that. Have a pass? Still works perfectly. Want to tap your phone? Now you can do that too. It's just one more way to move your way with Coda. Get moving now with Tap to Pay. Learn more at coda.com/tap.
There's still time to get holiday ready. Right Rug Flooring makes it easy with next day installation and 24-month special financing with approved credit. Carpet, hardwood, luxury vinyl, and tile. We have everything you need to make your home shine for family and friends this season. Schedule a free in-home estimate or find a showroom near you. Visit rightrug.com. RITERUG.com. Be holiday ready with Right Rug Flooring.
Right here, right now.